The Naturalistic Decision Making Podcast with Brian Moon and Laura Militello. This podcast series brings you interviews with leading NDM researchers who study and support people who make decisions under stress.
Welcome to the Naturalistic Decision Making Podcast. This is Laura Militello from Applied Decision Science.
And I'm Brian Moon from Paragian Technologies.
I'm so happy to welcome Joan Johnston today. Dr. Johnston has over 30 years of experience as a senior scientist with the U.S. Navy and U.S. Army. She has written and collaborated on over 100 publications and has given innumerable presentations and tutorials about her research. She has had a significant impact on advancing the science of learning, team training, decision-making under stress, performance measurement, and organizational development. Dr. Johnston's career with the Naval Air Warfare Center Training Systems Division, or NOCTSD, was marked by extensive collaboration across the Department of Defense, academia, and private industry. She was a principal investigator and project manager for the Tactical Decision-Making Under Stress program. ONR recognized her outstanding performance with the Dr. Arthur E. Bisson Prize for Naval Technology Achievement. In 2001, the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology also recognized this achievement with the M. Scott Myers Award for Applied Research in the Workplace. In recognition of her sustained performance excellence, NAVAIR made Dr. Johnston a Research and Engineering Associate Fellow in 2008. After 22 years, Dr. Johnston moved on to a promotion as the U.S. Army Research Institute's Unit Chief in Orlando, and then eventually joined the U.S. Army Research Laboratory as a senior scientist at the Simulation Training and Technology Center. She continued to work across agencies and services in pursuit of advancing the science of team training. She and her colleagues were recognized in 2016 for their outstanding accomplishments with the Department of Army Achievement Medal for Civilian Service and the NTSA Modeling and Simulation Team Award. Dr. Johnston's leadership on this program was recognized by an ARL 2016 Award for Excellence in Program Management. Joan, thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I know you're currently retired, but I wanted to go back to the very beginning of your career and ask if you can remember the very first paper you ever published.
Well, I made a lot of notes when I was looking at the questions that you had, so because I had to think back quite a while. It was back in the mid-1980s, and I was in graduate school at the University of South Florida, earning my degree in industrial and organizational psychology, and I had the opportunity to work at the Florida Mental Health Institute there, and we had this program evaluation that we were conducting on the state of Florida's community control program, which is where you had, instead of incarcerating people, they were allowed to live at home and have a bracelet on their ankle. It was one of the first ankle bracelet kind of incarceration programs. So they wanted to know what the recidivism rate was, how many people went out and broke the law and had to go back to jail. And they also wanted to know how it was perceived by the state's judiciary, as well as the community control officers that were running the program. So it was a really comprehensive empirical evaluation. And so one of the things I did was I went ahead and published the results of the self-perception of the community control officers and the judiciary. And it was kind of a geeky moment because I was able to use a non-parametric test to do their comparisons. And, you know, I wrote it all up. I was so proud of myself because I thought, oh, wow, you know, they're really going to love this at the journal. And the funny thing was that they came back and said, well, they asked for a rewrite and then they asked for another rewrite. And then they said, you know, we really shouldn't publish this paper. It's just too researchy. Can you just kind of eliminate all the references as you can to statistics? Wait a minute. But anyway, they did publish it. So that was my first, you know, opportunity to see what it was like to, you know, get something published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Well, so that's so interesting. What kind of journal was it that they thought it was too researchy?
Wow. I didn't even write down the name. I think it was Criminal Justice or Crime and Justice or something like that. Yeah, I know, it just seemed kind of strange. But I think what they were really getting at, which was one of the biggest lessons learned I ever got from my whole career, was you have to know your audience. And the audience in this particular case was the people who, you know, I was writing about, and they wanted to be able to get the plain message, you know, just, it was an empirical study, but we just really want to know what the takeaway is.
Ah, so you were really writing more for practitioners.
I should have realized that, yeah.
But so your very first, even your graduate work was very applied.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, I got my master's thesis from this particular project. Oh, wait a minute. It was a sort of a spinoff. It was a work safety scale. How safe do you feel you are in your workplace? It was one of those things where my professor, major professor, Dr. Paul Spector, who's well known in the scientific literature and on stress and job satisfaction. And he said, let's see what people think about their jobs as being, how safe they are. So he developed a scale and surveyed the community control officers, and I surveyed people working at the Florida Mental Health Institute in a psychiatric ward. And lo and behold, it was a good measure, but we wanted to know how valid it was. So that was the master's thesis. You know, let's compare the actual crime rate in different places around the state of Florida to the way people perceive their work safety. And actually, it didn't really predict crime rate, or crime rate didn't really predict, you know, perceived safety. It was mainly people were just afraid. But it was a good study in that, you know, we wanted to focus on how people perceive things versus the real world. And that was important to know, too.
So interesting. So even at the very beginning, you were very interested in kind of real world problems and understanding some of that messiness.
You know, I did. I had a job. I had already worked at a job in the government sector before I even started graduate school. I didn't start graduate school until I was 26. So I had a job. It was with the seed laboratory for the Department of Agriculture. So I had already kind of experienced the real world and, you know, had an understanding of it. And so I felt like, I guess part of my, you know, thoughts were, I want to be an IO psychologist. I want to work on helping people work better. And that was really just a basic idea that I had. So yeah, I guess I didn't really want to stay in a laboratory doing basic research. That was never really my thought.
Interesting. So it's not surprising you found your way to naturalistic decision making.
I know. And when I moved on after graduate school and started working at the Navy, and of course, you know, started working with Dr. Ed Salas and Dr. Jane Cannon Bowers on the Tactical Decision Making Under Stress program, it was just like walking through a door into an amazing opportunity to learn something about, you know, human performance and decision making that hadn't really been studied as much before. So it was a smorgasbord of opportunity.
Yeah, so I think about that time in the 1990s when the TADMIS program was going on, and you had that like amazing group there with Eduardo Salas and Jan Cannon Bowers and you and other folks. And that program really in some ways kind of solidified the NDM movement. I mean, there had been some meetings and the name had been coined, but really the TADMIS program brought together a lot of folks and funded some really important foundational work. And the work you all were doing on team training has been very influential. I'm wondering, how have some of those early insights from the TADMIS program really shaped your career?
Well, I'd say that it completely shaped my career. There was this moment when the program itself wound down in 1999 after 10 years. And it was just a whirlwind of activity and research with so many of these different people and programs of research areas. And it uncovered the work that we were doing in the very beginning, just uncovered this huge understanding that there was a lack of understanding about individual and team performance in complex technological situations. So it was clear in the very early days that this just wasn't going to be, oh, we'll do it in a few years and just wrap it up. You know, we had 6 years to really demonstrate something, but it just seemed like the more we uncovered opportunities to do research, it was like a boulder rolling downhill. It just kept collecting all these different groups of people and applications. It was really an amazing opportunity for many, many, many people. So it did shape my career. I think what I really wanted to do by the time the program wound down was to follow up with a lot of research that we had started later in that decade on automating and developing adaptive training environments for teams, and specifically for the Navy. That was seemed to be an even more complex problem than just doing the TADMIS research that we did, because now we were talking about software and coding software to do things that nobody had done before. And that pretty much consumed probably the next 5 years of my career after starting around 2000. And I think there were some really, really, really amazing accomplishments with that. But it kind of just sort of morphed into, I saw more opportunities to do international research collaborations under the NATO program, to work on other international collaborations under the research program that was across the five English-speaking countries, Canada, United States, Australia, the UK, and New Zealand. So the opportunities opened up for me in my career to cross-collaborate, not just within the Navy, but across services and then across the globe. And there are so many people who just had this huge thirst for understanding team performance, team training, and implementing it and testing it in the domains that they were interested in. So many of us that worked under the TADMIS program became subject matter experts. That was a magnet. People wanted to come to us and ask us, well, how are you doing this? What are you doing? And we were just pumping out publication after publication on all of these topics. And I listened to Eduardo Salas's talk that you had a few years ago on your podcast, and it kind of reminded me of how hard we worked. But I totally agree with his feeling about it, which was, you really want to try to get back to doing things like that. Once you've had that experience, you want to go back to or continue with that kind of experience, because it's so productive. You get to see and hear so many different ideas and incorporate them into what you're doing in your research programs.
So one phrase you said kind of caught my ear. You said, we uncovered this understanding that there was a lack of understanding.
Right. I know.
I was just wondering if you can think about, like, were there some like major perspective shifts about how you study training or what is effective training, how you design training? Thinking back to you as an early career researcher in this amazing context, are there any like big insights that you can recall?
Yeah. To kind of explain what I just said is that, we scoured the research literature to understand what was already out there, to explain, leadership within teams and how teams perform, how to measure team performance, and the, best training strategies, especially in the area of people who are expert in their jobs, but they work with complex technologies like a combat system on a ship, but there just wasn't anything really there. I mean, there's some really good data and research principles that we could draw from that the Army had developed originally and in the Air Force as well. But it was like we didn't just create a cookbook or guidelines on team training, but we had to actually create the ingredients. there weren't any, how do you do this? How do you measure, combat team performance? Okay, well, we're going to have to build the measures. And how are we going to be able to do an experiment so that we have realistic interactions among the team members? It's not just kind of faked up because you just have a game or something they're playing. Well, we had to figure out how to network computers together and use them to produce the kind of training environment that we would typically see combat teams using, and that it would have to have the kind of information that was realistic that they would be looking at and communicating to each other. We had to also there are a lot of stakeholders in this program. The people who manage training programs in the Navy, the people who were funding the research, there was just a lot of scrutiny in what we were doing. So we had to compromise. Compromise was not something anybody really wanted to do. You know, they just wanted us to just jump right on board a ship and just make it all happen. And we knew we couldn't do that. There was no way. So we had to develop very persuasive communications to explain, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to run these experiments. We're going to bring in subject matter experts from ship teams. We're going to do team task analyses. We're going to do cognitive task analyses. We have to do all of this because it hasn't been done before. So there was a lot of, like, as I said, effort put into creating a logical argument and demonstrating that we could do it.
Wow. Fantastic. I guess I'm thinking some of our listeners may not know TADMIS. So the context, you're in this command information. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the context of these teams and the complexity.
Sure. So the original reason for the program was that a Navy ship, the USS Vincennes, was in the Persian Gulf in 1988, and it accidentally shot down an Iranian civilian airliner, and all the people, of course, died when it crashed. And so this big investigation was dictated by Congress. The Office of Naval Research had to heavily fund a program to understand what went wrong. And there were a number of different initiatives, and the one specific initiative that we had when I was over at the Naval Air Warfare Center Training Systems Division was understand how to develop effective team training strategies. The main thing we had to do at the very beginning was actually visit combat ships and interview the Navy sailors who operated the combat system. The combat system in a ship is some very large computers in a single room inside the ship where there's at least 30 to 40 sailors who are operating the machinery and looking at information about what the aircraft, ships, and undersea vehicles are in a particular radius of the ship and actually the battle group. And so Navy's battle group has several combat ships, so it has an aircraft carrier and submarine and so forth. And so in looking on their combat displays, you can see that it's very complex. There's a lot of, it's just a mass of data and symbology that represent the aircraft and the ships. And they have to work through all of that as a team to understand what's not hostile, what's hostile, and what's unknown. And part of the problem with the shooting down of the Iranian airliner the big problem was that there was a confusion about what the operators were seeing, and they mistook the aircraft for an F-14 aircraft that they assumed was going to attack the ship. And it was coming from Iran. They thought that the general location was from Iran, and that would make it a hostile aircraft at the time. So that was the complexity of it. None of us had that experience. None of us were, had previous Navy, active duty Navy experience. So it was a huge learning curve for all of us.
Yeah. So when you were saying you were kind of reflecting on how hard you worked, like you were learning the command information center, you were inventing methods and measures, you were figuring out how to make these persuasive communications. There was a lot going on there.
There was. I think that probably the most telling part of it for me was when we went to the training facility for combat teams who were getting pre-training before going on a brand new ship. And it was in New Jersey, and we called it the combat ship in the cornfield because it was basically a combat ship. And we would sit down at the displays in the Training Combat Information Center, and the sailors would stand behind us and go, okay, this is what we're listening to. This is what we're looking at. And each of us would take a seat, and they would talk to us about it. They were great. They loved their jobs. They loved learning about, they loved being a team. They wanted to help us. and I couldn't listen to it for more than like a couple of minutes because it was everybody talking at once in both ears. I thought, well, how is this possible? You know, well, that was like one of the very, you know, very specific problems that people were hoping to solve, which was to make it less complicated, less busy, enable them to have the kind of focus that they needed. So there was a whole research topic on combat information display design that was managed over at a Navy facility in California. It's now called Spaewar Systems Center. I think it's even changed its name again. And they just focused on that. And so we had to collaborate with them to have a common research methodology to be able to make sure that whatever technologies and tools and interfaces they were using were similar to what we were using for the training side. Our feet were really held to the fire to make sure that we collaborated.
I'm glad you mentioned the training. I was going to ask about that. I mean, you've studied team training in so many different domains and contexts. I'm wondering if you could share kind of what you've learned that training organizations don't always consider. Where are you seeing the gaps in some of training organizations' approaches?
That was one of your questions that I pondered last week when I was thinking, you know, what am I going to say to this kind of question? I think the number one thing is there's nothing as good as doing a good task analysis. Having a task analysis, whether it's for the individuals in an organization, but for teams, especially a team task analysis is difficult to do, but it's something that has to be done if you really rely on teams for your organization's performance. And everything that you need to know and do comes from that task analysis. So there's plenty of organizations out there that know how to do them. It just really pays to invest in what you need to know about what your employees are doing, how they're doing it, how they need to improve, developing training objectives from that, and getting good training to address those tasks that they perform that are the most difficult and complex, especially if they work as a team.
Right. So can you maybe comment on some innovations in task analysis and team task analysis that came out of the program or even ones that you've developed since?
Well, that's a good question. Well, so the task analyses that it's still kind of a labor-intensive thing to do. I'm sure there's some software programs. I know that at least the military side, I know the Army had developed a really great task analysis tool that was a kind of a tablet-based tool. So I'm not really up on what people are using today as far as the technology goes. But when it came to doing a team task analysis, we had to figure out what exactly it was that the team did as a team. So we knew that no one team member was the primary performer as a team, that all the team members contributed in significant ways. So for the combat team that we were studying for the Navy, that team task was what we call the detect to engage sequence. That is, there's a timing and an accuracy to each team member's job that contributes to the overall combat picture that the main tactical action officer and the commanding officer need to have to make good decisions. And the way they push information between themselves and push information up the chain is the kind of thing you have to establish in that team task analysis. What is it that they're doing that other people depend on? What kind of data do other people depend on in your team in order to do a good job? So I believe that there's still a long way to go to create tablet-based automated tools for team task analysis. And I'm not aware that there's anything in the private sector for that. So there's still, you know, but the methodology is there. That was the one thing that I think I was really proud of with my colleagues is that we figured out how to identify and measure team performance in doing their task.
I think your point about the labor intensity is very important. And I think we've talked a bit more about that in recent years, about the labor intensity and the time requirements and even the costs of doing these task analyses, in particular cognitive and team task analysis. I'm wondering what kind of advice, if any, do you have for folks in the community to grapple with that question, especially for sponsors?
Well, I think it's really important as more technology is being used to, I'm going to speak to the military context. So for example, you know, more and more unmanned aerial vehicles, surface vehicles, and undersea vehicles are being developed. And with intelligent agent technology, the capacity to change a mission on the fly with various military tools is something that can have a huge impact on the human in the loop, I think. And those task analysis tools should really be developed to understand what the impact is on human performance. This is this human agent teaming concept that's been, you know, written about and researched probably for the last 15 years or so. So I think it's even more important now to have really good tools for tracking the impact that, you know, modifying missions on the fly with different technologies will have on the team's performance and an optimizing team performance. It's more important now than ever before, I think.
So I agree. And I think the point you started with about just the importance of a careful task analysis, I find myself making this case all the time. I think there's always this question is, why does that take so long? Like, if you're going to develop training, why would that take so long? I think people really, really underestimate the importance of that and the importance of doing it thoroughly. So another thing I have admired about you is you have many times been able to bring together these highly effective research teams that include DOD, academia, private industry. I'm wondering if you have any lessons learned about creating effective multidisciplinary research teams, because people come with different priorities, different perspectives, different methods. How do you make all that come together?
That's a really great question. And again, another one I pondered for a long time. I have my notes here. Well, the main thing is you have to have the money to do it. You got to have lots of money for team research. But I think there's really good reason for the funding, and you have to find a sponsor, you know, some organization that's really got a problem. A lot of it kind of points to, I would say, safety, human safety, and maintaining a safe work environment, or in the case of like TADMS, making sure people don't make like critical mistakes. And that, you know, that kind of drives the funding, I think. And that once, you know, once you've got that kind of support and you know what kind of what you want to provide your sponsor with, the next major thing is to make sure the people who are working with you on a project like this actually understand team performance. It's really hard to work with brilliant people, but if they've never done team research or team training or anything like that, it's a learning experience for them. So they have to learn. And there's a lot of effort that goes into educating. There still is. Number three is there's educate. I think most of our projects started with everybody needing to understand what the research objective was and what it was going to require. I think the reason I had such good research teams is because we started out together in the very beginning of the TADMS program in the early 1990s. And many of those organizations, those companies, I was able to continue working with them for at least 15 years, and with some of them for my entire career. So I really gravitated toward making sure that I could access people who knew what team performance was. So those three things, you know, having the funding to do it, you know, making sure people could do it because they had the skills to do it and the knowledge. I would say also time. It takes a lot of time to do research with teams. It's not just a three-year thing. It definitely can take probably 5 to 7 years to do a really good research program. Or for some people like Wink Bennett at the Air Force, I mean, it's an entire career. Eduardo Salas, it's an entire career. It's still an entire career for somebody, I think.
Yeah. So, and I think I heard in there, one of the things that worked for you was you kind of have this coalition of researchers that you interacted with, and maybe other people joined the team, but there was this core set of people that had a lot of experience with team research that you were able to carry forward.
Now, I did sort of had a bookend. I feel like I sort of had this bookend career with TADMIS in the beginning, and I finished up with a program of research we called Squad Overmatch, where we did something similar with Army and Marine Corps squads. The squad is about 9 people in the Army, and it's 11 team members in the Marine Corps. And so I didn't have a lot of people on my team for that project who knew a lot about team performance, but I did have some people on my team. I made sure I had people that I had worked with sort of running each part of the project, and that I reached out to some really old colleagues, the people I'd worked with for quite some time, and said, would you please work with me on this project? It turned out to be, again, getting back to this, it's hard. It's one thing to try to convince a sponsor to give you funding for a project. That's a certain, you know, set of salesmanship skills. But then convincing your own team that they need to do team research, that was the hardest part in this more recent study we did. It started around 2013 and finished up around 2018. In the very beginning, I spent a lot of my time just telling people you have to do it this way, because you're never going to get where you want to go if you do it that way, which is your way. So yeah, I probably spent a good 2 years, you know, they finally broke down and said, okay, we'll do it your way. And they liked it. So if you have to, at least if you're running a team on team research, you yourself have to spend a lot of time educating people.
I love it when researchers are honest about like how long it takes and how much persistence is required, and not getting discouraged when people don't just agree with you immediately. I think it's easy to kind of look back and kind of pretty all that up and make it seem like it all went super smoothly. So I really appreciate your kind of reflecting on how hard that was.
Yeah, I think it's one of the hardest parts of the job. It's really fulfilling, you know, finally convincing people that they need to do it a certain way. And I'm certainly compromise. And I'm not saying that I was, you know, just authoritative or autocratic, but you do have to draw the line at some point and say, I can't do it unless you do it this way.
Yeah, so when you think back over your career, have there been barriers that were more difficult to overcome than you expected?
I would say yes, that one of the biggest disappointments, but I should have known better, I just didn't, is that we created an unrealistic expectation that all of the research that we did under TADMIS would magically transition to the Navy. The Navy would just embrace everything that we did and go, wow, this is great. We're going to improve everything. We're going to change everything. And basically, it didn't happen that way. It was more of certainly a victory of research. And I believe that the biggest impact we had was creating this raft of research that then inspired other people to do more research. And that now, about 20 years later, a lot of the principles of team performance are now part of the vernacular of the research community. And it's also made its way into more popular publications and books and so forth. And I don't credit myself for that. It's definitely something that I think Eduardo Salas had a tremendous amount to do with. But I guess what I really had to learn was that it's small steps to get the military to take something and modify it so that it can actually use it. I think there were a few things, though, that did actually make it into the curriculum in the Navy, and that was what we called team dimensional training. That was a teamwork training strategy that Dr. Kim Smith-Yench spearheaded, and the submarine community latched onto that and started using it in their combat team training for every single combat team. And I think that was a huge, huge win. When we thought it was a great win, but now I look back on it, and I think it was a much bigger win than we thought it was.
Yeah, I think that resonates with me and with a lot of people. The early in your career, the expectation that these research findings and insights and tools will make their way into the operational world more seamlessly than they do.
Yeah, I think one of the things that one of my major professors in our graduate school said, Ed Levine said, it takes 20 years for the research to make it into, it takes 20 years to make it into the common public knowledge. And I think maybe that might be speeding up with ChatGPT and some of the other AI technologies. It might move a little more quickly, but that resonates now when I look back on it. It takes about 20 years at least.
Well, I'm glad that we have at least one example that you mentioned where not only did it make it into the vernacular, but you had the training success story, because that was getting to be a bit of a downer, the idea that it's going to take so long and you may not even ever get there with the sponsors, but you have had success.
Oh, yeah, there was success with that particular training program. And I think also I need to credit the Naval Space Warfare Center for helping redesign combat system displays. I think they had quite a few wins in that area where new Navy ships adopted better combat displays, better information presentation strategies. It's pretty important that that impact is also described. We had this one study that we had to do at the very end of the TADMS program in 1999, where we actually combined training and combat display modification. And we got some really good results with that. Had to do the experiment at Surface Warfare Officers School in Newport, Rhode Island. And we were able to show that there was better teamwork, better decision-making, less confusion and cognitive workload, having that extra display for the combat operators. So empirically, it worked out really well. And I think the big successes that came from that program, I think, as I said before, really more in the adoption of that, the methodologies, the measurement strategies by the research community. And it's just exploded. It's just amazing to me. I can't even begin to count the number of research studies with teams that have been conducted since then.
Yeah, I do think it's so important that we, and that's part of the reason for this podcast and the NDMA generally, is to promote those success stories, to show the evidence, you know, where we can get it. Would you say that's one of your most fulfilling studies, is because you were able to show those differences, or do other studies or projects over the years, do you reflect on them as being fulfilling in different ways?
I think one of the biggest fulfilling experiences I've had overall is having been able to, as I said, kind of educate a research team on specific research methodologies, you know, how to design a research test bed, how to do the measurement, how to do the training for a team, et cetera, et cetera, and designing the scenario problems that you need to be able to train specific skills. I've transitioned that knowledge over and over and over again to anybody that I've, you know, spoken with or given presentations to. I think just being able to educate on that and have people be able to then go on and do the work that they needed to do, that's really fulfilling. As I mentioned, the Squad Overmatch project, I think, was next to TADMS, one of those very, very fulfilling, because we were able to tackle being able to do this with Army and Marine Corps squads, which are infinitely more difficult to perform as a team than being on a Navy ship. I mean, I just didn't understand the complexity being an infantry member. And we successfully were able to take the same principles of TADMS, transition them to that, to a training environment for infantry teams, use live and virtual training environments, and combined stress exposure training, team training, and decision-making training in the same training progression. And we saw significant improvements in decision-making and team performance in those infantry teams that received that, what we call the integrated training approach. And it was just very, very, very gratifying, because, as I said, I think it was infinitely more difficult to do that than the TADMS program. I was pretty exhausted at the end of it, but I think we actually had some pretty good transitions out of that because it was focused on combat tactical TC3. It was training them on how to be better at managing combat casualties as a team, and then focusing on combat and managing the casualties during combat, and then moving casualties to where they could be handled by a medic. So we were able to add a medic to the teams, to each of the combat teams, and improve their training because the medic was embedded with the trained team instead of separate training, which would just never seem to make any sense. So we really had a huge team of people working on that project, and it wound up affecting the way in which the Army procures the TC3 simulations that they have around the country, and making those training simulations more available to soldiers in training in different places.
Yeah, that also feels really important just because of that sort of domain transfer, in that you found principles and ways of studying in one domain and you found that they were very applicable in another domain. I think that's kind of, to get back to that efficiency question, maybe something we should be stressing more, is that this community is quickly able to find those cognitive dimensions, those team performance dimensions, because we've seen them elsewhere.
Yeah, it's not trying to reinvent the wheel. I was really glad to be able to find that opportunity. And that actually, if Laura remembers, we were out in El Paso, Texas on that study for Border Hunter. And remember that?
Yeah. Right. We were roommates in the Army barracks.
Yeah, that's right. We were in that crazy bunkhouse that was just had the like a century old bathrooms. But anyway, that was great though, because I was able to work with all of you and Greg Williams. He was just so super to work with on the
amazing. Yeah.
Advanced situational awareness work. But I wanted to be able to do this squad overmatch study way back, back in the 2008, 2009, when we were starting to see so many problems there were so many problems with soldiers and Marine Corps and the Marines in Iraq and then in Afghanistan, where they were just having so much trouble with being able to manage the combat they were in. And it really took another, 8 years before I actually saw the opportunity where we could actually do something about it. So that's where I started looking for another TADMS opportunity way back then. And it took a while, but I finally got it.
So speaking of thinking ahead, I know you're retired now, but if you had a chance to do one more research project, is there something else that you have kind of loaded up that you think, if I had the chance, that's what I would have done?
Well, the last position or job that I had, we had some changes to our organization at the Army. So I was with the Army Research Lab, Soldier Training Technology Center. That organization, SCTC, was transferred to the Soldier Center, which is located in Massachusetts. Okay, we stayed in Orlando, but as our lead organization, it was Soldier Center, which was a better fit. And some of our research on teams and team technologies was thought to be, continued to be very important. And so fortunately, we were able to keep working on team research and adaptive tutoring for teams. And what I wanted to be able to do, and I decided, there just wasn't the time or the funding to do it, and I really just wanted to retire. But I really wanted to do a study I'll describe as the challenge. The challenge is following a team, an intact team, is a folly because teams have constant turnover. And so the assumption is that, teams develop over time and that, they can develop this crazy high level of expertise if they're together long enough and they get the kind of training and experience. But that's kind of an unusual case. And what I think is more real is that teams, they definitely develop over time, but with this influx of new team members always coming in and going and experienced team members going out, there's this opportunity to that needs to be, if you're going to focus on training and development, I think you have to be able to tweak that training to be able to address the current needs of a team. And I think it would have been interesting to do what I call a known group study, where you took a slice. You had an opportunity to look at novice teams in the military, for example, at initial military training. And then you also took a slice of teams that had formed right after deployment, and then teams that had been on deployment for, and just to be able to get a much richer understanding of the profile of that level of expertise at different points in time. And I think that would do a much better job of informing the kind of training that you need to have and the education and a lot of different things, you know, for soldiers, for, doesn't really matter what team, whether it's military or not military, but I think that would reveal quite a bit more about what teams need in order to get better and, you know, manage their skill areas. So that was kind of where I wanted to go with that.
So just to make sure I understand, so the current needs study, the idea would be to study teams at kind of different levels of maturity? Interesting. Yeah, that's a very cool idea.
Yeah, I just think it would also, research-wise, it wouldn't take as long. It just wouldn't. You know, you could just say, okay, let's go here, here, and here. We're going to have these many teams at this level of experience and so on and so forth. And instead of it just being, you know, taking a long time.
Yeah. So, okay. So I see that we are kind of coming up to the top of the hour. So I'm going to kind of jump to the end here with sort of a fun question. If you could instantly achieve expertise in anything, what would it be?
Well, I would really like to be able to play a musical instrument. I know how to play the piano, but I never really got that good at it. But I would really like to get a whole lot better, like at the violin or piano or any musical instrument. That would be a wish of mine. I think also I would like to be able to, I know this is kind of geeky, but I'd really like to do more with artificial intelligence. I'd like to be able to be better at mathematics and analysis to be able to do it. It just seems to me like it's such a huge opportunity area for work. It could be fun.
Yeah. And so what about the intersection between AI and music? Is that...
Well, yeah, that's... I saw something the other day. There's a video of a guy that took the Fibonacci sequence, you know, the golden rule, and he created music with it using AI. And like he physically played it, but he used AI to help him plan out, you know, like Fibonacci is, you know, it's this almost unending sequence of, I guess, numbers, but it's a pattern. So, you know, they went from the pattern to a musical piece, and it was really beautiful. It's just really amazing.
Wow. Very cool. Well, gosh, Joan, this has been so fun. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm just really glad I was able to catch up with you. I really enjoyed working with you when we did. And Brian, it's nice to meet you. I don't know if I've met you before. That's really weird. If I have, I'm sorry. I didn't acknowledge that.
No worries. I'm not sure we've ever met in person either, but we'll someday, I'm sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, on that note, thank you for joining us. For the NDM podcast, I'm Laura Militello.
And I'm Brian Moon. Learn more about naturalistic decision making and where to follow us by visiting naturalisticdecisionmaking.org. Thank you.